And I'm an alcoholic. Friday date is June 29th, 2009, and I have a home group. It's Downtown Young and Sober. We meet Thursday nights at 8 o'clock in Norfolk, Virginia, at Epworth United Methodist. So if you're in the area, come see us. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I sponsor women. And I've been through the big book with a sponsor, line for line, paragraph for paragraph, page for page. And I, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I started drinking. For a long time, I thought I started drinking when I was 9, but then I realized that my sister wasn't born yet, so I must have been 8 when I started drinking by myself. And the first drink I had by myself, I was in a fuzzy pink Barbie nightgown, and I was mad at my dad because he was drunk again. I didn't really know what drunk was, but he was thrown up, and he went and passed out, and I was mad. I was the only one besides him in the house for some reason. So I climbed up on the counter and got into his liquor cabinet and went outside and tipped it up, and that's all I remember. And so that was about 8. And then I remember when I was 11, I started drinking more often by myself, and I would make my friends drink too. And I remember getting frustrated with my friends when they didn't want to drink. I wanted to drink pretty much every chance that I got, even at that age. And my dad had this huge wine cellar, and within 3 months, I think in between maybe 5th and 6th grade, I cleared out that whole wine cellar. And I used to sneak out at night and go up on a hill behind our house and just drink like crazy. And I remember just, I remember it giving me comfort, and I was painfully shy. Like, I would turn purple when I got embarrassed. Excuse me, anytime like a teacher would ask me a question in class, I would turn bright red. My scalp would turn like bright red. I was so embarrassed. And I couldn't speak very loud because I was so scared and so shy. And that helped with all that. It helped me feel like I could participate with other people. It felt like I could talk to other people. It felt like it gave me more confidence. And I didn't know what any of that was called. But even like, even during the day, like at recess, I would take the little tiny bottles and go in this big tire on the playground and drink them in the middle of the day, like in 6th grade. And so I started drinking at a very early age, and I felt like the need for it at an early age. Now I look at 11-year-olds, and I just can't even believe that I was drinking like that. And I think I was 13 when I went to my first treatment center. I remember being in the getting like an assessment done to see if I needed inpatient treatment or not. And I was 13, and I told them that it wasn't a problem because I didn't drink because I liked the taste. I just drank to get drunk. And I thought that was the right thing to say. Found out later that was the opposite of the right thing to say. So that was my first treatment center. And I was pretty far along at 13 years old even. I was so incredibly rebellious that I would do the opposite of anything that anybody told me, and whether I wanted to do it or not. And I think I was running away already at that time. I would sneak out at night already. I was taking my mom's car at 13 years old and driving to the next town over, picking up buddies on the way and everything. I did that like every night for an entire summer, I think when I was 13, 14 years old. From 13 to 18, I was in juvenile detention centers, treatment centers, psych wards, like 29, 30 times. I probably spent more of my teenage years locked up someplace than I did free. But I went to a long-term treatment in Chicago when I was 15, and I think I was there for about 3 months, and I finally decided I was breaking all kinds of rules, just rebelling everywhere. It just kind of had an FU attitude in general to anybody. And I finally decided that maybe I would actually give this thing a shot since, you know, I was already stuck there anyway. As soon as I decided that, all the staff had met and decided to kick me out. So I was like, I took that personal. It was like I was crushed. And it's like, well, this is what I get. You know, I just decided to start trying and then, you know, I get kicked out or whatever. So I pouted at AA for a little while after that. Blamed AA for a lot of different stuff that happened in my life. When I was 16, I made an attempt to get sober again. I was chairing a meeting. I had a sponsor by name. Wasn't working the steps, didn't talk about literature really or anything. It was mainly just fellowship. We did a lot of, there was a whole crowd of people around my age and just a little bit earlier, like late teens, early 20s, and we did like weekend retreats. We did just like, I don't know, we'd go, a bunch of us would get together and go sledding and dances and little parties and stuff all sober, but it was really just mainly just kind of fun, just young people having fun. And I think I had like maybe 6 months at that point, chairing the meeting, all arrogant and everything, and I had was still hanging out with people that I used to drink with and party with and go clubbing with, and I drank, I think, a 12-pack of non-alcoholic beer, and I was just announcing that to everybody, letting everybody know, and a person had been there for a while, an old-timer, said something like, non-alcoholic beer is for non-alcoholics. And and you know, kind of said a couple other things, and of course I got angry at AA and just disappeared, left that for a while. And I still, like, I was, well, I had quit school, I think, in eighth grade. I made honor roll 1 year and then failed the next year because I just wasn't interested in committing or doing it, being responsible for anything. I just was on the go, running constantly. And I had, you know, slit my wrist a few times and tried to, you know, commit suicide or whatever. I listened to my sad, depressing music and watched myself bleed and sobbing. It was like this really dramatic, total BS thing. It was all self-pity, wallowing. And I wanted somebody to notice. Like, I wanted to be the center of attention, but I didn't know what that was called or what that looked like. I just wanted things to be different. And I did not know what was happening. Even though I was exposed to AA, I was exposed to treatment centers, I really still just thought, and for a long time afterwards, thought it was about drinking. And I saw my dad was a functional alcoholic for as long as I can remember. I mean, he started drinking with Bud Light in the morning and then went to Jack and Seven in the afternoon and drank that until, you know, he passed out every single day. And he always went to work, never missed a day of work. That's really what I was going for. Like, you know, I can handle the hangovers and the feeling sick and the, you know, even the other consequences, but I just wanted to be able to participate in the world. I wanted to be able to make ends meet, basically, and drink like I wanted to drink, and it never worked like that. So I still just was kind of managing. It wasn't as out of control, but I still knew that it was a problem sometimes. I got into a relationship that was sometimes abusive, and I had moved in with him, and things were kind of going south, and I told him that I had a good job and I was starting to go to AA again, and I told him that I was going to leave the next day. I was going to go into an abused women's shelter the next day, and he had been partying with his friends or whatever. We got into a huge fight. He ended up shooting himself that night. He had the gun to my head first and said, "You want to go with me, B?" And then shot himself in the mouth. And to me, that was, now looking back, of course, I took it personal. It happened to me. I never considered anybody else, family members, his mom, that happened to. It was all about me. And to me, that was untreated alcoholism, because he had a football scholarship to any college he wanted to go to. Everything looked good on the outside, but he took it that far. So now I know that that was something else that was going on with him. But I went to a meeting that night, and I remember, like, just kind of, I was sobbing. I was a zombie for a long time after that, and I was in this huge meeting, and I was telling what happened, and somebody in the across the room interrupted me and said, how does it make you feel? We're not interested in hearing what happened. How does it make you feel? And I was crushed, because I was just a zombie. I was completely raw and vulnerable, and that shut me down, and I held that as a resentment against AA for a long time, and I don't think I came back for another 5 years, I think. And I was, so during that period, I was a zombie, complete zombie, for about 6 months or more, and I was doing anything that anybody put in front of me, wasn't really eating, wasn't really sleeping, became obsessed with what had happened to me, and my drinking just went off the roof. And I ended up in jail for 30 days. My probation officer was afraid I was going to kill myself because I was so just out of it. And then it seems like about a year later, I kind of snapped out of that zombie thing. And evidently, I'd gotten married, had a baby, like all this stuff had happened. I was a complete zombie. I wasn't really participating in my life. And I never wanted to get married. I never wanted kids. I just like snapped out one morning and was working full time, going to school three nights a week, and was married and had a kid. And I was just like, what happened here? And so I bolted. I did what I do best and just ran. And I had some sob story about, you know, the papers that I was served with didn't have the court date on them, blah, 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 blah. So I didn't show up. So my ex-husband got full custody of our daughter. And I was told to just finish class and then we'd go to court and explain everything. Well, that was just one of my tickets that I used as an excuse for drinking more. So, you know, I went off again and was just, the job that I had, every Friday night we'd play poker and drink and smoke and stuff like that, so it was like acceptable where I worked, and that was one of the jobs that I held the longest, of course. They were just like me. But so I went pretty crazy for a while, and it was part of the fuel kind of in my head was that I had lost my child. I was really ashamed of that and really embarrassed. And I think I was 23, I got my first DUI, and this person that was doing assessments for treatment had talked to me and convinced me that I had a serious problem with alcohol and that the short-term treatment centers and just going to AA didn't work, so I need to go to long-term. So I voluntarily went to long-term, and I stayed there for about 9 months and then just walked out one day. And because I had been sheltered for so long, I was shaking just seeing beer cans on the ground. I was just so not used to it, and I wasn't used to having the choice there, basically. It just kept me away, and it was more of a behavioral modification. They would punish us by taking meetings away. So, again, through this whole time, it's still in my head the alcohol. Like, I always said I was an alcoholic, but to me that meant, you know, I drank too much sometimes, and I got consequences sometimes. It's, you know, I lost control sometimes. I didn't really understand what alcoholism was. So I went in treatment, I left treatment, I think I got a year chip, and about a week after I got a year chip, I was hanging out with somebody I was in treatment with, and we drank together. That actually happened several times. People that I was in treatment with, I would hook up with later on and drink. But I don't think it took very long. One of the blackouts that I had, a lot of my old friends like to tell everybody this story, that I was getting ready to go into a blackout. And all I remember is I was holding somebody's hand, and he said he had a razor in his hand. And I said, just go ahead and do it before I change my mind. And that's all I remembered. And I woke up the next morning and passed a mirror. I had a little line of hair here, a little line of hair in the back, and like two long strings right here on the side. That's it. It was all bald. They had shaved my head. And that scared the crap out of me. It was just humiliation, really. I went running back into AA. I knew several people in AA, so, yeah, my whole family was crying for a long time when I did that. I wore hats everywhere I went. So I went back to AA again, and I actually started making an actual attempt this time to really work the steps. I got a sponsor that was Big Book-based. She had a lot of the 12 and 12-2, but she started taking me through the steps. And this was the first four-step that I did was more of a, she had actually taken it from a treatment center where she worked, and it was a huge, like, workbook type thing, and it had a lot of questions about, like, you know, did you kick somebody in the fourth grade, and, you know, were you horrible to your parents, and just specific questions that are meant to, like, dig. So I thought that a four-step was more like a confessional, just kind of, you know, confessing, getting things off your chest, telling somebody your whole story only. I didn't understand. Later on I found out that it's also to find out my character defects, so that I can ask God for help with them. But, so I think I lasted about 9 months, and during that period of time, this was in Northern Virginia, and we started a couple of young people's meetings. I had a core group of people that we were there was a lot of fellowship, we did a lot of things together, a lot of fun stuff, we went on trips together, and all kinds of stuff, but we were all also solution-based. It was the first time I was really introduced to, you know, practicing these principles in the Big Book and carrying the message and things like that, and that was kind of a taste of it. And I started seeing things that were completely different. But then I got pretty cocky. I get cocky pretty quickly. And I was living in a sober house at the time. I was working at the patent and trademark office. I met this guy. And one morning he was reeking of alcohol. I knew he had stayed up all night partying, and I told him that I was an AA, and he just broke down and asked me for help. And I was like, sweet, you know, I can help, you know. And I didn't tell any, I didn't ask any of the guys that I knew for help or anything. I just, it was my goal to help him, and this is my opportunity to be of service and all this stuff that I told myself. And I just masqueraded as trying to be helpful, but I wasn't interested in helping him. And I knew that I was starting to slide already anyway. I was going to therapy during this time, and I asked my therapist to put me on antabuse because I was thinking that that would kind of prevent me, you know, if I did decide to drink again, that that would kind of prevent me or at least be some kind of a barrier. But I stopped taking it or forgot to take it a couple days in a row. And when I had made the decision to drink, and I had pulled away from my sponsor at this time, and I was the only person that had the key to my home group, the church that my home group was at, and I didn't show up one time, so they had a meeting out front. And so when I decided to go back out again, I asked a pharmacist if 2 days off of antabuse was enough, and she was like, yeah, you should be fine. It was not good. I was in bathroom after bathroom after bathroom. It was horrible. And so I stayed with that guy for a little over 10 years, I think, and I was in and out of the program, and things got really, really bad. Throughout this whole time, my oldest daughter, we kept in touch. I would get her for weekends. I'd get her for a week, you know, or two here or there or whatever. And I just didn't, she still wasn't a priority to me. I tried to make her a priority at different times. I also used school. I would enroll in classes very quickly after I drank again or if things started getting out of hand. I had a job that was making a lot of money, and I was hoping that that would be the most important thing, and that would keep me in line. It did not work. I tried a lot of different things, the relationship. And, you know, it used to irritate me so bad when people in meetings would say, this is a life or death situation, you know, this can kill you, you can die from this, and it was just like, whatever, roll my eyes, and, you know, I was like 26 and 28, doesn't apply to me, this is stupid. And you know, I had already, I think by that time I'd definitely driven into a pond in the middle of December and somehow knew to roll my window down and get out and tread water and get to the side, like in and out of a blackout. And they told me I shouldn't have been conscious at all then. So I'd already done that. I think by that time I had already flipped my car 5 times and rolled out of the driver's side window as it rolled off of me. You know, I'd had a gun to my head, and I still did not, I thought that was so stupid to say that you can die from this thing. It just made no sense. And again, that happens to other people. But it's weird, because I mean, so hard-headed, so stubborn, and so, you know, I knew so much better than you guys. I pay attention. I have always, like, interviewed people. I love information. I love learning about people, so I collect information all the time and how you guys do it and how, you know, what your opinions are, and I just collect this all the time. So I have a lot more information than you guys do. So, you know, and I kind of, this wasn't a conscious thought. It's just, I just thought I knew a better way, or I had a little different version than you guys, or I didn't need to necessarily do all this stuff. And, you know, again, it was never a conscious thought. So then I started understanding that, okay, you know, you can die from this thing, bar fight, you know, car accident, I can kind of get that stuff. And then I can't remember exactly what happened. I just went back out, and I was trying to maintain things the best I could, but that never worked well, and I always played the victim. It was all everybody else's fault. They weren't giving me a chance, and, you know, if only they would see it my way and stuff like that. And then it got really bad, just physically. I was drinking. It got to the point where I was coming, well, let me see, I got pregnant, and I couldn't stop drinking through the pregnancy. And the best I could do was get to a hospital, but my tolerance was so high that by the time they could legally give me something to help me off the alcohol, I was already seeing rats running across the floor and already in pretty bad DTs. So I would leave. I couldn't take it. I'd pull the IV out and leave. And pregnant the whole time. I wasn't really eating. I was drinking pretty much the whole time, and that that just absolutely wiped me out physically, that because the baby comes first in my body, so it was just sucking all the minerals, vitamins out, just ruined my health. And after that, after I had him, I still couldn't sober up. And again, it was like the best I could do was get to a hospital and then pull the IV out and walk out. And so 28 years old, and about every week I was ending up in the hospital with bad pain. I was having pancreatic attacks. I had alcoholic hepatitis. And then I woke up one morning and couldn't feel my legs. And my mom drove from Virginia Beach to Arlington to take me to the hospital, and I found out that I had alcoholic neuropathy. And it was central nervous system damage. And I couldn't feel my legs from, like, mid-thigh down for about 4 years. And so 28 years old, and the doctors told me that I had about 2 months to live if I kept drinking. And a couple of friends from AA had come to the hospital with me, and they had talked to the doctor. And afterwards, one of them told me that they said that it was going to be my pancreas. It was going to explode. That was what was going to kill me. But they also told me not to come back to that hospital. They basically wrote me off as a lost cause. You know, I'm not going to stop drinking, and it was just a matter of waiting now for me to die. And I was like a grayish yellow, and it was just skin and bones, and it was just horrible. You could tell I was dying pretty quickly. And I had gotten an assault charge on my boyfriend maybe about a year before that, and the court had, I had not complied, I had not taken anger management classes, so suddenly there was a warrant out for my arrest. I had to go in front of the judge, and my boyfriend's father, I was renting the basement from him, he went up in front of the judge sobbing and told the judge everything that, you know, all the medical stuff that was happening to me from drinking, and the judge looked at me and said, I'm giving you 4 months to dry out. It was like, it was just a domestic situation, it was the first assault charge as an adult, and it wasn't that big of a deal, but he gave me that time just to dry out. Like, it was that clear that there was a problem with alcohol, and they didn't know how to help me. So that was really the first time I could not deny that God was involved in my life. I mean, there was no way I should have gotten 4 months for that situation. It was absolutely ridiculous. He's literally 6'4", you know, 285, and it was just no way. And there was no other explanation, but there was no way that God could get in there. I wasn't leaving the house. It was just me in that little room, you know, not moving. And my days consisted of coming to in the morning. I would drink vodka, be throwing up the whole time from withdrawal until it could seep in a little bit into my system, and then I could stop throwing up. And I might take a bite or two of food a day. And then in the nighttime, I would just pass out and do the same thing. That was for about 6 months I lived like that. And I was so weak from not eating that I would have to go up two flights of stairs to get to the bathroom, and I was too weak to do that. So I had buckets everywhere. I was living in a basement. I had buckets of every bodily fluid you could think of, and I would just put towels over them. And I had just urine, blood, vomit all over me. I went to court like that in front of the judge, standing there with T-shirt, sweatpants, with stains all over me, and I had a bottle of Gatorade that was mostly vodka, because I knew if I stopped drinking for 20 minutes, I would start going through withdrawal again. Like, I wasn't even getting drunk anymore. It was just maintaining barely above withdrawal. It was horrible. But I remember passing the bottom of my stairs thinking, and I just looked up the stairs and just thinking, I'm never going to make it up those stairs again. Like, it was just horrible. And I could not believe, at 28 years old, a female, you know, that had so many opportunities or whatever around AA, was in that position. I just did not think that it was possible. And that was crazy. And you would think that would be enough to make me stop drinking forever. But I went to jail. I went through DTs for a week and a half in the medical ward or whatever. I was actually seeing, and I can still remember it today, clear as day, just like any other memory I have, little animals in the walls. And I was trying to pick them out because the wall was closing in on them and tightening up and crushing them. So I was trying to get them out. Every finger that I had was just bloody nubs when I came out of the DTs. They had to x-ray my ankle because I was trying to kick the door down because there was a man eating a baby on the other side of the cell door. And I had put little medicine cups around the cell to feed the animals. And I remember, like, some of this stuff, even the ideas, like I was trying to save these animals in the wall. And so I was pounding on the door to get one of the deputies come over, and he was, like, looking at me like I was crazy, and he was saying, there's no animals in the wall. And I was thinking, if I could just get him over here, and then he'll see that the animals are in the wall, and then he'll have to help me. So I was like plotting this kind of stuff, and it was, none of it was real. And golly, so a week and a half of that, and there was a lot of stuff that I don't remember that people were telling me afterwards, and they were swearing up and down that I was coming off of some drug or something, and it was just alcohol. Taking alcohol away from my body, and that was the physical reaction that I had. It had become a necessity to my body functioning. And so I was in jail for 4 months, and when I got out, I was staying with a friend that was in the program. She was very involved in service, in the traditions, things like that. And I found the first sponsor that really took me all the way through the steps, and that was really kind of started putting the whole picture together. I used to hate tradition studies and tradition meetings. It's just, this is pointless. This is the politics. It's for other people. It's, you know, people that want ego highs, they go into the tradition stuff and service. So I started kind of getting the whole picture, the three sides of the triangle. And the sponsor that I had was awesome. She took me through the book and really explained things to me. And that's when I started learning really about what alcoholism was, as far as, like, I started listening to, about the mental obsession and the allergy of the body. But I still didn't quite, I still was coming in with a whole lot of knowledge. You know, I thought that I had been able to quote the big book for a long time, thank you very much, and the 12 and 12, and I know a lot about the literature and the history of AA, and, you know, just crazy thinking. And so I wasn't as open to information that people were talking to me about. So she took me through the steps, and then I kind of just leveled out around 12, and I thought, at 3 years sober, I didn't think I was ready to sponsor yet. There's a lot more information I need to get, and, you know, I just need to get a little better, and, you know, all this stuff. It was just excuses and lies that I was telling myself. I had no problem speaking all over the place just because I had a crazy story and, you know, different things that I'd gone through and made it through, but I didn't have a solution. I wasn't living it. And, like, my sponsor's mother got sick, so I felt like I was a burden if I was talking to her about things. And I also, the only thing that I seemed to be hearing in meetings were people talking about, you know, how much they've changed and how wonderful things are, and now, you know, I'm sane, and now I'm this, and I wasn't hearing anybody talking about crazy thoughts or making stupid decisions. And so I decided that I was just really sick and I must not be sober and I can't tell anybody what's happening in my head because they're going to tell me I'm getting ready to drink or, you know, something is just not right. So I kept it all to myself and I stopped talking to my sponsor because she had other things to deal with. And I was just kind of running on it. I would do service stuff. I would go to assemblies. I was GSR for my home group. I would do things that looked good. But any one-on-one stuff and actually practicing principles in my life, I was not doing at all. I was actually hitting my boyfriend at home, and I was stealing from work. I was just doing all kinds of things that were not spiritual. My boyfriend was drinking the whole time. He seems to handle it better than I do. But one night I was mad because he had been out late and was coming home late. And so I was like, well, I'm just going to show him how it feels. So I left, got a hotel room, got a couple of bottles of wine, and drank again after 3 years. It was like a few days short, I think, of 3 years or something like that. And I drank again. I had kind of been pulling away from meetings. I mean, I've drank after leaving a meeting before. I've drank after getting off the phone with my sponsor before. Like, these are not the things. And those are the things also that contributed to me saying, I've tried this before. It doesn't work. You know, I've tried AA, it doesn't work. And after, like, praying once, I've tried praying, it doesn't work. And, you know, just bullheaded and my own ideas and stuff like that. So I drank again. And my body has already gone so far down that I can only drink, like, about once a month, and I'd end up right back in the hospital. But I kept trying. I didn't, you know, you got to work at it. And I had so much pride because I built myself up so much in AA, and I knew so many people around Virginia and had been so involved in service and running my mouth and my opinions everywhere that I was just too embarrassed to come back. And so I got a second DUI in Alexandria, and I did jail time for that a couple weeks or something, and then I came straight to Virginia Beach after getting out of there. I stayed sober. I didn't drink for about 2 years. I think, at Virginia. And this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe in singleness of purpose, and but drugs are a part of my story. And I had gotten into a car accident about 2 years sober, I think, or maybe like a year and a half, and I had gotten on pain medicine and had become hooked on it, and I couldn't understand why I couldn't get off of it. It was horrible. And I actually at one point considered, like, wow, I'm just going to have to be on pain medicine for the rest of my life. But when I started becoming aware, and this has started happening after I got here, started becoming aware that no matter how much I pray or how hard I work the steps or how honest I am, putting that stuff in my system was blocking me off from the sunlight of spirit. And there was nothing else that I could do about it. It was just like a shadow, and I couldn't will it away. I couldn't get past that. So I started realizing that maybe my perception of my pain is off. And that's when I really, oh man, it's just like, that's a huge lesson I keep learning over and over again, that my perception might not be accurate. Because I think, especially when I take a few minutes to really get into thinking and figuring stuff out, I am absolutely right in the way I see things. I mean, how could you not see that? And then I find out I'm wrong. So physically, there's nothing different in my body today, and I don't need painkillers every day. So it really was like, and to me, I mean, I don't know what other people think or what's correct or whatever, but for me, I feel like, you know, my alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. This is a progressive illness. So even when I'm not drinking, it continues to move forward. It continues to grow in every way, not just, you know, well, if I drink again, it's going to take more to get me drunk. The obsession of the mind gets stronger. I mean, for me, everything, the pull gets stronger. And, I mean, that's what I've noticed. And I feel like alcoholism, cunning, baffling, and powerful, it is sneaky. It will sneak up on me. It looks like a relationship that I want. It looks like relief from painkillers. It looks like, you know, a lot of different things. But for me, it's still alcoholism. It's kind of like, you know, anything that it can use to get me off track, anything that it can use to distract me from my primary purpose, it will. And it's really good at it. It knows what I will fall for. And, you know, that really started helping me, thinking about it kind of like a separate thing almost. I mean, it's a part of me, but like my illness sounds like me sometimes. It sounds like it could be God-inspired sometimes. And I mean, that's one thing that I never did very much was run things by other people and stay close to my sponsor. And this time, I was dry for like 2 years, and I was trying to work the steps and stuff when I got to Virginia Beach. And then I started realizing that I need to get off the pain medicine, and the withdrawal was so bad, I drank again for a couple days and then didn't get off the pain medicine, had about a month, and then finally got off of it and drank again. And now I have about 2.5 years sober. But so I finally kind of just didn't care what the risk was. I just wanted to get all the crap out of my system. So that's when I started learning more about like the obsession of the mind and what happens and how it can lie to me. So now this time around, it was wild because after I got sober this time, for the first 2 weeks probably, I was still convinced that I'm not going to make it. I'm just one of those people, and I went to a meeting, and, you know, sometimes I can say that, you know, oh, it must be God because this just happened, or I'm struggling with something, and I go to a meeting, and they're talking about it. Wow, it must be God. But I went to a meeting, and three people mentioned where it says in the big book that that they might not be able to or can't get it or something like that, and they were going into depth talking about it, and I was like, they're talking about me. I'm one of those people that cannot get this, and for whatever reason. And so I thought it was a sign. It's like, wow, I've served my purpose. You know, I've shown people that how scary it can be and, you know, how it doesn't matter how old you are or if you're a woman or a man, you can still die from this thing and all this kind of stuff. And for 2 weeks straight, I thought that. And then a friend of mine popped a speaker CD in, and they were talking about the exact same thing. I mean, literally, he said word for word what I had just said to my friend. And I was like, wow, I'm not the only one. And that's another thing. It's like, wow, I always fall into that thinking I'm the only one that feels like this or the only one that thinks this. And that's another thing, by talking to other people. I have a lot of people in my life that I talk to on a daily or semi-daily basis because I can't trust my own thinking. And for several different reasons. Like, I need to run my thinking by other people, one, to find out that I'm not the only one that thinks like that. And it's such a relief to find out that I'm not the only one that thinks like that. And then two, to kind of run it by somebody else to see what maybe the sane version of that might be. And then three, it's, you know, I don't get postcards from God. I don't get, like, you know, emails from, I don't get actual direction, you know, that's obvious to me from God. And when I have people in my life and I participate in those relationships, those are opportunities for God to get to me. So, you know, the more opportunities I give God to get to me and to guide me and to help me, then the better off I am. And I've definitely done that a lot of times, isolated myself, and then it's just I'm left with my own thinking. And, you know, I can't tell when I'm spiritually fit. I can't always tell, you know, when I'm thinking sane. To me, I mean, just ask me. Any ideas that I have, you know, are just right on. You know, I've figured some stuff out, and geez, so that's another reason that I keep a lot of people in my life today. And another thing that I've learned, too, is that I used to think I would have, like, a list of people to call, and I'd be like, oh, they're probably working, they're probably spending family time. They're probably, like, in 5 seconds, I will go down everybody in the list and figure out why they're not going to answer the phone or they don't have time for me, or that I'm going to bother them. And, you know, now that I'm sponsoring people and I'm there for the people and I'm giving people my phone number, what a relief when somebody calls me and interrupts my thinking. Gosh. And so I know now that it is helpful when I call other people, when I ask for help. I'm not burdening people. I'm actually helping them get out of their heads. Because when I do get crazy and I play with it a little bit too long or whatever, I'll get irritated with people for interrupting my thinking. Like, I'll be in a whole fantasy world, you know, figuring some stuff out and plotting some stuff, and, you know, I'll get a phone call or my boss will ask me to do something, and I get very irritated because it just interrupted my whole thing. But, so then I have to, like, tell myself, oh, yeah, and say a prayer, you know, it's not about me. But it's about helping other people. And that's another thing, too, is, like, I used to get really nervous about, like, sponsoring people or even talking to people one-on-one. It's like, that's a lot of responsibility. Like, how can I, you know, get them sober or whatever, and that's not the case. Like, the only thing that I have to share is my experience, strength, and hope, and that's it. Like, what's happened to me, what's been told to me, what's been shown to me, that's not any kind of, like, you know, I can't go wrong with that. Like, what's worked for me is, and I got a lot of different times that I've been in the program, I got different kind of, like, fluff, and, you know, like a lot of treatment stuff, philosophies and therapy philosophies. And I had a couple of therapists tell me that I had every right to be angry with someone that wronged me when I was a little kid. And that I, you know, it's understandable. And basically telling me to go ahead and kill myself with resentment. You know what I mean? It's like that's what they're taught. And I understand that may work for some people, but not for me. If you give me a loophole or an out, I'm going to take it, you know, and if you give me a little bit of leeway, like, you know, oh, just be a little bit easier on yourself, because I'm like, okay, you know, and I go nuts. So it's like I really got to watch it, and I need people around me that are going to tell me the truth, and I need people that are going to kind of keep me in line, and my sponsor's like that. She has no problem laughing at me and, you know, doing these little one-liners, zingers, and telling me like it is, which is awesome. Now I can just laugh about it, but, you know, I was afraid of that for a while, and it's like, you know, I don't know, it's just, that's all I have to share with people, and to be real, and my perception, again, is really, really off a lot of the times, and being of service to other people, even if, like a friend of mine was saying, I felt like I needed more sponsees, because I need to go through the big book with somebody, I need to be focused like that, and then they were saying that, you know, in the big book it says that our real purpose is to be of maximum service, to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and people about us. It says the people about us. It doesn't say the alcoholics about us. So then it's like that's really started helping me break things down just in little bits of my life. So I have a 4-year-old daughter. You know, how can I be of service to her? And, you know, my mom, how can I be of service to her? It's like whoever is around me at the time, at work, how can I be of service to my boss? So breaking it like that, it's like every day there are thousands of opportunities for me to practice these principles in all of my affairs. And another thing, too, that I really saw when I got to the Virginia Beach area, I was still pretty hesitant about reaching out to people or getting close to people. And I got pregnant. I would go back and see my boyfriend all the time in Arlington. And I got pregnant with twins. And then I was put on bed rest at like 2 months pregnant because they had twins for transfusion, kind of became the survival of the fittest. And I was still, I had a home group, I had a sponsor, I was kind of working the steps. But then I lost one of the twins the day before I delivered. And one of my home group members paid for her to be cremated, and my home group got together and took a collection up. And for me, because the surviving daughter had a lot of medical problems, issues, and she came home earlier than we expected, so they took a collection up and helped me with diapers and formula and stuff like that, and they had been talking about bringing meetings to me, and it took me about a year, even after that happened, for me to actually see what they did for me. And it wasn't, it's not like I'm saying, you know, get sober, they give you money, and, but... It's the first time that I really, I remember times fighting with people about, no, I have real friends today. They're really going to be there for me and blah, 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 blah. People that I drank with, they're nowhere around. But these people, I still am a member of that home group, and they have put up with me. Oh, my gosh. Like arrogant. I mean, at one time I would just come into business meetings and just puke all over them and tell them how it should be done and then not show up to the meeting for another month. And I just, and they bit their tongues. They let me go through my little thing, and now I'm like on great terms one-on-one with every single one of them, and that was the first time I really saw like the power of a group to help me, and it wasn't like, you know, miraculously I was cured at that moment or anything like that, but it just really showed me what this is about. People that didn't particularly care for me or didn't really think that I was going to make it even, they joined together and they helped me anyway. Like, it was just amazing for me. Excuse me. So now, another thing that helped me out a lot, like, you know, my whole life, I was very rebellious, and if I didn't feel like doing something, I was not going to do it. Like, I didn't really care about anything. Like, jobs were disposable, relationships were disposable, I just didn't really care. I never really got that attached to stuff, so it was not a big deal if I lost it or whatever. And so people around here were saying that no matter how we feel, we have to do this anyway. And I just kept hearing that over and over and over, no matter how I feel. And then I started getting that. It's like, if I don't feel like doing something, I do it anyway. And also, if things are going well, and I feel great, and I feel like high off God, and, you know, all this stuff, I still have to do this anyway. And, you know, if I feel bad or depressed or sad or lonely, I still have to do this anyway. It's like, there's never, for me, there's never a good excuse not to participate and not to continue showing up. That's huge for me because, again, like if I get any kind of a loophole or a break, I'm going to take it. And that has really helped save my life. And perspective still continues. Like there's this, my closest friend today, there was a time, a long time, that I did not like her at all. And I judged the crap out of her. It was just horrible. She was nasty. She's mean, this, that, and the other. And I would tell people, really anybody that would listen, that, you know, I just don't like her, and I don't have to. You know, I don't have to like her. And I didn't put in there that, but I still need to love and tolerate her. It was just, I don't like her, and I don't have to. And then it was pretty wild because my boyfriend had killed himself, you know, like, what, 18 years before or whatever. And I've always believed that everything that I go through will be useful someday to somebody. And she, her boyfriend killed himself last year, this month, and I was there for her. I know exactly what it feels like to go through that. I know exactly what it feels like not to be allowed to the funeral or the wake because the family blames you. Like, I was able to be there for her, and she knew that I felt exactly how she did. And she asked me questions constantly. We were on the phone every day, and that kind of helped us. You know, it was like when I found out that he died, everything that I had thought about her was out the door. I was there for her just to be of service. And but even since then, we've remained close, and I look at her today, and it's like, I don't even know what I was grabbing onto, like, why I disliked her so much. I mean, she has changed some, but, I mean, not so drastically that she's a different person. And so I remember that now when I start judging somebody and thinking that they're a jerk or whatever, because I just, you know, I can't always trust my perception on things. Excuse me. But, yeah, I'm going to get stuck now. But today I have a home group. I'm involved in the home group. I sponsor people. I stay close to my sponsor. I pray on a daily basis. And I'm not perfect at this stuff. Still, by far, I'm not perfect at this stuff. And I seem to go through these little phases where I'm doing everything I'm supposed to. And, you know, I'm feeling much better. I'm feeling much better. And, you know, wow, am I the only one that's doing all these things that I'm supposed to? And I, like, kind of start looking around, and it's like, wait a minute, why am I the only one doing this stuff? And I start judging everybody, and it's like, I can't believe it. I heard what they said in a meeting. They're not doing that stuff. And, you know, and I just start pointing out everybody, and then I start getting angry, and then I stop doing the things that I'm supposed to do because I'm judging everybody else. I'm getting resentments all over the place, and then, of course, I start, like, declining, and then I'm just angry all the time and feeling crazy again, and then it's the same thing. And then it's like, oh, crap, my butt's on fire. I need to do this stuff again. I've been resting on my laurels. So I start doing this stuff again, and then it feels much better, and I start looking around, and why am I the only person doing this? And it's just, and I wish I could see it coming. You know what I mean? I wish I could learn from other people, and that's just not how I learn. I seem to always have to do things myself. And I know also that things that I judge people for, especially harshly, seem to always happen to me. So I try to be careful now, but I already know, like, I'll be judging somebody for being arrogant, and then, wow, they just made a fool out of themselves publicly. And I know that that's going to happen to me. Like, I'm going to, you know, run off at the mouth and be all cocky somewhere and then, you know, be wrong or something. But, I mean, it's cool to also realize that, you know, I got a lot of people around me today that, you know, have 2 years, 10 years, 20 years, 26 years sober, and I still drill everybody with questions. And it's just awesome because they're all so honest about where they are today and about how they still have crazy thoughts and do crazy things and aren't perfect. And it's just a constant relief for me because sometimes I do put so much pressure on myself that, you know, I should know better by now. I should know how to do this stuff. I do know the big book well. And, you know, but I'm not self-sufficient, thank God, because I wouldn't need meetings or God if I could just handle it myself. Like, I never think of, you know, the exact line in the big book when I need it. You know, I can hear it from somebody else. So, but thank God I'm not self-sufficient because, I mean, I need you guys. And, oh, man, and the day that I think that I don't is scary. But that's another reason why I stay close to everybody and stay close to meetings because, again, at any point in time, cunning, baffling, and powerful, it's amazing how cunning, baffling, and powerful it can be. Like, I don't see it coming. That's the whole point. I can't sit there and say, wow, that was a crazy thought. You know, maybe I need to go to a meeting. I mean, maybe some people can, but I don't. It sounds absolutely rational to me and not a big deal. Just this once, you know, just this week, I'll start doing it again next week or whatever the, you know, ridiculous excuses that go through my head, and I don't recognize it for what it is. I don't have all the answers, and I can't always see things coming, and I do not have a complete grip on this thing, nor do I completely understand God. So I just try to do what I can do on a daily basis, and that's all I've got. So thanks.